I was in from Colorado, and what I couldn't get at that time was what actually was information on the 12-tone composition, on 12-tone technique, anything. I couldn't find books, nothing. So when the parents said, we're going, this was 1957, we're going to Europe for the summer, would you like to stay in Europe for the next year and study? Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm packed. I'm ready to go.
Right.
And so by the time we got to Vienna, we did some looking around. I said, this is the place I want to stay. And didn't speak a word of German. And so I was in Vienna for a year, attended the opera every night. And I came across Hans Erik Apostel. You know the name?
Yes.
And he was the last member of the 12-tone school. He was the last student of Schoenberg and Webern and Berg. And all those. He knew all those people. He was also, you know, Manon Gropius? She was the angel for whom the violin concerto.
The Alban Berg.
Yes. And Apostel was her piano teacher. And then when she died, of course, and Berg wrote the violin concerto, Mr. Apostel wrote the program notes for that. So it has this connection. It all comes together. So I was so fascinated with that. And I studied, and he only took two students, so I was very lucky on that. It was a wild time. I mean, he hated all the contemporary composers of that immediate period. That was Stockhausen, Boulez. Hate them. Cage, hate them. And so I had to look into all these people because if it's that intense, I want to know what's going on. So that's what I studied there. And then I returned. When I returned to the USA, I said, what am I going to do now? I can't go back to Colorado. I went out to San Francisco. I finished up my first degree there. I got my master's with Luciano Berio and Dario Smio. It was Berio's first visit to the USA. He came with Kathy Barbarian, his wife, who sang all the avant-garde stuff in Darmstadt and what have you.
And also some Beatle transcriptions,
she did Beatle, and she did Monteverdi.
And she did Monteverdi,
yes,
too.
Yes,
that's
and
right.
She was a lot of fun at parties, I can tell you. Kathy was a lot of fun. Oh. And then every other year, Mio would be there at Mills College. Every other year, he was at the Conservatoire in Paris, and then he would be in, and he was wonderful.
I mean,
we were very, he and his wife were very kind people to me, very generous.
Well, that's great. Well, we'll be listening to a brief selection of Robert Moran right after we take a very short break.
WPRB is supported by the Princeton Record Exchange, an independent record store with over 100,000 new and used LPs, CDs, and DVDs in stock. Located at 20 South Tulane Street in downtown Princeton, the Princeton Record Exchange carries the latest new releases and reissues, rarities and collectibles, rock, jazz, classical, movies, TV shows, and more. They will also purchase your music and movies for cash and put them into the hands of people who will appreciate them all over again. For more information, call 609-921-0881. Find them on Facebook or visit them online at prex.com.
Well, good morning. The time is 3 minutes after 8 on Wednesday, August 2nd, and you are tuned to WPRB, Princeton, New Jersey, community-supported independent radio at 103.3 FM, or online around the world at www.wprb.com. Welcome to another edition of Classical Discoveries. I am your host of this program, Marvin Rosen, and we'll be with you today until 11 o'clock. I am also with you now on Monday mornings from 5:30 until 11 for Treasures of Early Music. Just want to let you know that I will be with you next this Sunday morning from 7 until 10:30 for a special edition of Treasures of Early Music as I sit in for Thomas. If you don't know already, today on Classical Discoveries, we are presenting a Moranathon in observance of the 80th birthday of Robert Moran, who was actually born on January 8, 1937. Between now and 11, we are listening to a varied program of many of his works. And Robert Moran, as you already know, is here. We listen now to this very brief piano composition. Thank you. You were just listening to Waltz in Memoriam, Maurice Ravel, by my guest Robert Moran, as performed by Ivar Mikhashov. Well, this short composition began the entire Waltz project, and tell us a bit, Robert, about this project. It's kind of an amazing thing, and there's some really wonderful contemporary music in
it. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much. I was living in Buffalo at the time. This was in the summer of 76, and I was waiting for a friend, and I just sat down at the piano and was sort of diddling around, you know, you do at the piano, and all of a sudden this happened. It just fell right into place, and I wrote this down very quickly. And this friend dropped by, and I said, let me play this for you. Mm-hmm. And I did, and he said, that sounds like Ravel. And I said, you mean the second movement of the piano concerto, which, of course, we both adore.
Yeah.
Know, right?
Yeah, we talked about that about three minutes ago.
It's to die for. It's so beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I said, well, I'm going to call it Waltz in Memoriam, Maurice Ravel. And then I said, I wonder, you know, it's so crazy writing waltzes. No one writes waltzes. I got on the telephone and called up Robert Helps, pianist, composer who lived in Brooklyn at the time. And I said, Bob, I think I'm losing my mind. I really am. I just wrote a waltz, and it sounds like Ravel. And he said, well, that's strange you say that, because I just finished a waltz myself, Waltz Mirage. So I said, why don't I fly to New York? Why don't I drop into New York? Mm-hmm. Let's meet and have lunch with Mrs. Hendrickson, who was then the president of C.F. Peters, a music. And let's suggest to her that we find other composers who, for free, there was no money exchange on the, would write a short, no longer than 5 minutes. And I made out a list, and Robert made out a list. He knew people like Sessions, Babbitt, that, and I knew the wacky crowd, you know, the Nam June Pecks, the Cage, the Glass, all those. So we all went, and we had lots of people on that list. We had Bernstein, we had Frank Zappa, all this, and we couldn't get some of these composers. They were all interested, but we couldn't get them because they had exclusives with other publishers. So that was the problem there. But all of a sudden, these started arriving, the pieces coming in. And we put this together, 25 contemporary piano waltzes, which were published and then recorded by Nonesuch.
Nonesuch. Right.
And that's when choreographers grabbed this and said, oh, this is a perfect, you know, vehicle for new dance. And Peter Martins contacted me and said, would you be interested if I did it here with New York City Ballet? Well, they're fabulous.
Yeah, sure.
They're fabulous. And so that's what happened.
Because there's some really beautiful stuff in that. And I'm thinking right now a piece in that collection, which I love, and I've performed it many times over the years, is that Little Waltz of Lou Harrison.
Oh, I was going to say, isn't that beautiful?
And he used that actually in his Third Symphony
as
one of that also. But I remember playing that. That is such a perfect little two-minute gem.
It's a gem. All right.
It is really a gem. Well, you have a very, I guess you could say, a real connection with one work on the Waltz project, Philip Glass's Modern Love Waltz. How many times have you transcribed that?
I can't count them. I've done so many variations of that for different groups. You know, piano circus, multiple ensembles of different instrumentation. And so this is one that I did that I think you would.
Yeah, this is recorded by the Premier New Music Ensemble of Philadelphia. And mm-hmm. this is a recording which I picked up many years ago. It also has your 10 Miles High Over Albania, mm-hmm. as well as 49 waltzes for Tokyo by John Cage.
Right.
But we have this version of Modern Love Waltz by Philip Glass, and we hear it now again as performed by the Premier New Music Ensemble of Philadelphia. Thank you. music by Philip Glass, as arranged by my guest Robert Moran. That was Modern Love Waltz, as performed by the Premier New Music Ensemble of Philadelphia. And that was one arrangement of Robert Moran of about
several hundred,
I was going to say.
Several hundred, yes. So,
well, let me ask you this question very briefly. What was it about that piece that made you do so many of those?
I thought it would be fun to do that. I thought it would be fun to add different colors to it and see what would happen. And we always had a good time working together, so there was no problem.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Well, speaking of Philip Glass, you co-wrote the opera, The Juniper Tree, with him. Give us just a bit of the background, how this collaboration worked, and a bit about the opera itself. Actually, you wrote one part, he wrote another part. It wasn't like you did each the whole thing together.
No. It was a collaboration, but it was like we selected the individual scenes we wanted to do. Juniper Tree, of course, is Grimm's fairy tale.
Right.
And it has the most outrageously horrible stepmother, cruel stepmother, that you possibly can find anywhere. So, of course, she's perfect for opera. The person who suggested that to me, and then I turned it over to Phil, was Maurice Sendak, because The Juniper Tree was his favorite. And he said that he thought that would make the best opera. So Phil and I had decided to do this together. It was his suggestion. And we went up to August. We were up in Nova Scotia in 1984. And wrote the work up there. And then it was premiered about a year later, in December 85. And it will be done next week at Wolf Trap. And it was done a few months ago in London, in England. Mm-hmm. And it keeps spinning on. Yeah.
So this is a Robert Moran greatest hit, basically. Right? Well, what is your most popular work right now? Trinity Requiem?
I guess Trinity Requiem, yeah.
I read that. Well, we'll talk more. We'll be hearing the entire work in just a little while. But let's listen to the final three sections of Act Two from The Juniper Tree.
Do you These want are me to by... explain what is happening
yeah,
here?
Yeah, why don't you take
a real quick one.
Yeah,
The stepmother has been totally out of control. She's managed to chop off the little boy's head. That's her stepson. And she put him into a stew, which Daddy ate, and said, oh, this is really wonderful. The little girl, the stepsister, the daughter of the stepmother, is turned into a vegetable because she's watching all of this. And she's actually been set up as the murderess of her own brother. And so this horrible thing is happening. But the magic bird, of course, is the little boy who's been transformed. And he goes around gathering up things like mill wheels, which he's going to drop on stepmother, and various gifts for the. Anyway, it ends up with stepmother is killed, and Daddy and the two kids have a scene of, what should we say? Yeah. They're reunited and everything ends.
Of course, everything ends well.
Yeah. Now, Phil has two kids, and he said to me, but Bob, aren't children in the audience going to be terrified? And I said, no, Phil, come on. They'll love it. They love this violence. Yeah. It'll be the mothers and fathers that freak out. And that's what happened. You know, the kids loved it. And the parents were sitting there like, oh, my God,
What did we get into?
What do we got into? Just more grand opera, massacre,
that's
and murder.
Right. That's what it sounds But it's a delightful opera. I mean, the music is wonderful.
Yeah, thank you.
The music is wonderful. And let's hear it.
All right.
We're going to listen to, from Act Two, the interlude. Then that will be followed by Scene Two and the final scene. In our performance, our vocal soloists are Sanford Sylvan, Lynn Torgove, Valerie Walters, and Janet Brown, and they are accompanied by the Juniper Tree Opera Orchestra, conducted by Richard Pittman. This is music by my guest, Robert Moran. We hear selections from the opera, The Juniper Tree. Thank you.
yet, an old friend will visit. What a day that will be.
You were just listening to selections from Act Two of the opera, The Juniper Tree, by my guest Robert Moran. We heard the interlude, then scene two, and then the final scene. Again, selections from Act Two. In our performance, we heard vocalists Sanford Sylvan, Lynn Torgove, Valerie Walters, and Janet Brown, and they were accompanied by the Juniper Tree Opera Orchestra, conducted by Richard Pittman. Music by my guest, Robert Moran.
WPRB is supported by Rego Auctions. Rego offers sales of fine art, jewelry, 20th century design, coins, and furnishings year-round, and provides free estimates of value on all property suitable for auction. One of the country's largest auction houses, Rego is located within minutes of Princeton in downtown Lambertville, New Jersey. To find out more about selling a single object, collection, or estate, visit regoarts.com/Princeton. That's RAGOARTS.com/Princeton. Or call 609-397-9374.
WPRB wants you to know that the Trenton Area Soup Kitchen Task invites you to help feed the area's less fortunate residents. The Soup Kitchen is located at 72.5 Escher Street in Trenton. For more information about volunteering with Task, please call 609-695-5456 or visit www.trentonsoupkitchen.org. And this has been a public service announcement from WPRB Princeton, community-supported independent radio. And we are back with the man of the hour, Robert Moran.
The hours.
Since 5 a.m. this morning. And we are hearing a tremendous amount of your music today, and we still have a number of works to get to, and we'll be going towards the end of the program to a couple of your, I guess you could say, early, more experimental things. It's hard to believe. You know, one thing which I find so amazing before we get to some of the other things here is the difference of your style. I mean, it's some, you know, like listen to the things or discuss the things we're going to do now, mm-hmm. the city mm-hmm. pieces, which mm-hmm. we'll talk briefly about in just a moment. But you contrast those. I mean, look, they're much earlier with Trinity Requiem. Mm-hmm. Could this be by the same composer? I mean, and one reason why, and I mean this very sincerely, that a whole big marathon type of program of your music works is because your style is very varied. You know, every piece is different. I mean, you see the style, you hear the trademark, you hear, oh, this is Robert Moran, when you hear Seven Sounds Unseen, or you hear The Voices of the Last Seal, you hear, this is the Robert Moran sound. But then when you contrast it with some of the earlier work, some of the orchestral pieces that have almost that minimalism mm-hmm. effect to it. It's amazing. I mean, the number of styles you've written in contrast is amazing.
Well, thank you.
Let me ask you one question before we go to the early stuff. Music like Trinity Requiem, Seven Sounds Unseen, mm-hmm. you know, some of those very beautiful choral works. Mm-hmm. When did you start writing works that were so ethereal, choral compositions?
Actually, I didn't do much choral work because no chorus had asked for music. And the person really responsible for that was Alan Harler, who was a conductor of Mendelssohn Club in Philadelphia. And he's the one who commissioned the original, the Requiem Chantecine, which was done with, when was that done?
That's a long time ago.
1990 or
something like that.
Yeah. And that was done at the Basilica in Philadelphia with the Mozart Requiem. So he said, I said, what can I have in the way of forces in this huge space? And he said, we have the Mozart chorus, we've got the soloists, we've got the orchestra, the original size orchestra.
Right.
I said, good, I'm going to divide that up in four sections, and there are going to be four different parts in the Basilica, mm-hmm. one at the back, one at the altar, one at the back organ balcony, and two on either side of the audience, and equal, so I could divide up the Mendelssohn Club. And then that was
the beginning.
Great success. It went off to...
I remember there's a beautiful Agnus Dei around that time, if that was from the same
that word? Came a little bit later.
A little later.
Yeah.
But you also have you have such a wonderful feeling of the space you're writing in. The work that I played earlier, the choral work with the cello and the harp and all that, the voices of the...
Voice of the last seal?
The beautiful... Just explain briefly about that, where you wrote that. That was for like a cathedral.
Voices of the Last Seal was written for my friend Alexander Hermann in Munich, and he did that in that area.
Spatial quality.
Yeah, but I've always loved these. They're very dangerous acoustics in cathedrals. It's usually about the big cathedrals are about 8 seconds to 10 seconds decay.
The delay.
You make a sound, it takes that long for it to decay. So if you play a fast Bach fugue or something on the organ, within seconds it's turned into mush by the time it's reached the end of the cathedral, you know. So I always loved floating sounds in that type of space. Mm. And that's how it happened.
Well, I mean, like I said many times, the choral music you've written is just unbelievable.
Thank you.
Well, we're going now to something different that's unbelievable. And I am talking about your works, very early works, written for entire cities.
Yes.
Share with us a bit about some of these. I mean, there was the Pachelbel Promenade and some of these others.
Well, you know, I could go on for hours because it takes hours to explain how this all happened. Well, but I remember very, very clearly, and it was 1969, there was a San Francisco sound. Janis Joplin, Grateful Dead, all these people.
All that great stuff.
And so they wanted to do a big festival in Golden Gate Park. Well, that fell through, but they said to other people, would you consider doing big works for ensembles here and there in the city? And I thought, oh, this is going to be, nothing's going to work. So I went to the meeting anyway, and I proposed this and that, and then they called me up and said, let's do it. And I said, can I have this? Can I have that? And I originally proposed a concerto for solo voice, since I knew Janis Joplin personally. I said, I'm going to have her center stage yelling, amplified at the top of her voice, and Hell's Angels going around the circle in this big stadium, around at full volume. And they said, no, that's a little bit too way out.
A little bit over the top.
That's a little bit over the top, Bob. But I thought it was just that Janis loved the idea.
Well,
but
sure,
anyway,
yeah.
But I said, okay, I wanted Twin Peaks in San Francisco. We're going to put up automobiles up there. Let's use the radio station, as I knew, KQED, KPFA. Let's use the television. And we did this. And that's what happened. We used the amplified, you know, and there was a mandala of numbers, and it told people how to play their house lights, work their house lights, or their car horns throughout the city. And so from 9 until 9:39, which was determined by the I Ching, the ancient oracle book of that John Cage.
Yes.
You know, it always ends back up at John Cage, doesn't it? And so that's what
we
did. And that was had such... I stood there. I thought, this is... You know, we're going to have... This is the period of riots.
There were no riots. It was a musical happening.
It closed the city down. People were dancing in the streets, the San Francisco Ballet, groups from all over. Then, because of that, the second piece was the Pachelbel Promenade in Graz, Austria. And that was another... Well, then the second piece was Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, Hallelujah. And that was for all the musical groups in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Senior citizens were making signs, were balloons, what have you. So the whole city, and it was really like John. It was like Charles Ives.
Oh,
you know, it had that feeling of Charles. I found myself when this was going. And you know, when it starts up, the composer is the least important. It's on its own. It really takes off. So now the city's performing itself. And I found myself wandering in a very dark graveyard in a cemetery in the center of Bethlehem. And I sat there on a tombstone listening to all of these sounds going on around me. It was amazing. I mean, there was like a choral group from this Catholic church which would keep singing and move over to the steps of a synagogue, which was having, and it was on the birthday of Shakespeare. So we had lots of different inputs to the, so that was that. And then, of course, the third piece was Graz, Austria, and they've done that more than, You know.
Interesting. Now I want to go to another experimental piece. And this is one I would love to have done with students. I think this could be incredible. You know, it's funny. I could imagine, and you know which one we're talking about, I could imagine my students in Princeton with all these sound effects walking around Princeton during the lunch hour.
Uh-huh.
And I'm talking, of course, about your lunch bag opera, which mm-hmm. you can actually see on YouTube.
Well, no one wanted at that period of time. No one wanted contemporary opera in the opera houses. So, okay, if that's the case, if that's your attitude, we'll do it outside. And so I wrote this piece down that at any major city at lunchtime, there would be a group of walking lunch bags sized like telephone booths, but about that size. And they would be walking so that there'd be groups of these people inside these bags with toys.
Yeah,
whistles, what have you.
Slides and all that. Yeah.
So I knew friends at BBC Television, and they said, would you consider coming here and doing it? I said, let's do it. So here in this, you know, with the Bank of London and all these people in top hats and tailored, you know, very elegant, all the bankers. And here they're being followed by groups of bags. And it was covered by BBC Television.
Oh, my God.
So you can see that, as you know, on YouTube.
When you look back at the works like that now, what's your reaction?
Well,
It was a different time.
It was a totally different time. And many of these things, city pieces, I don't think would work anymore. Mm. I mean, it's a different time and period.
They would probably, in our world today, want to.
Now we've gotten inside the opera house and causing trouble.
Yeah. Well, I have a feeling now, and please excuse my silly pun, they would probably in 2017 want to bag it.
To bag it. I think we bag it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, but now I don't want to bag my next question, because you have done radio yourself.
Yeah.
And I think it's very appropriate for you to tell us share a little bit about that with us.
Well, a good friend of mine, Howard Hirsch.
Oh, I'm sure.
Howard?
Oh, sure.
Okay,
sure.
Howard was running, head of music at KPFA, Pacifica Foundation. That was Berkeley. And so he said, Bob, would you like to take over one evening, like every other week, I think it was, or every week, Wednesday evening, and you could start at 11 in the evening, and you can go on until we close the station down, whenever you want to. And it comes on the next morning at 6 for news. Mm-hmm. And I said, sure, that sounds like fun. So then I thought to myself, what am I going to use as a name for this show? And at the same time, I was living at the top of the Castro Hill mm-hmm. in San Francisco, yeah. just around the corner from Janis Joplin. So we walked our dogs together, right? And I said, Janis, what's happening? She says, I've got rid of Big Brother. Now I'm looking for, you know, I'm putting together this second group. But I don't have a name. And I said, well, I'm thinking of for the show. And if you don't want it for your group, I'm going to take it. But let me know quickly. It's called Capricorn's Collision. She was a Capricorn. I'm a Capricorn. So mm-hmm. So off we went. And she said, no, I love Collision, but I'm not sure about the Capricorn. Yeah. And so she ended up with something, Cosmic Blues. I don't know what that group. It lasted 10 minutes, you know. And I did the show at KPFA. And then after a while, I moved over to KQED. And I had a wonderful time experimenting with radio.
That's what it's all about.
It's really wonderful. It's a wonderful medium, and it's so important in Europe. Radio is so strong in Europe.
Mm.
You know, it's...
Yeah. So what type of thing, very, very briefly, because I want to get to one of your greatest hits, as we call it. Tell us what you did on the air then, just very briefly.
I could do anything I wanted to. I mean, it was really outrageous. This is during the 60s, and early 70s. So it was up for grabs. And we had a wonderful time. And guests would come in. And it was a very special moment.
Wow.
We could never do that again now.
Well, and I guess our next piece we go to proves that. To contrast dramatically with what we're just discussing, we go now to your Trinity Requiem. Mm-hmm. Which was composed in observance of the 10th anniversary of 9/11. The work is scored for children's chorus, four cellos, harp, and organ. And we will hear this work in its entirety. However, before we do, why don't you give us just a bit of its background?
Well, Robert Ridgell, who had gone from Philadelphia to Wall Street, Trinity Wall Street, and he was the organist there, commissioned this work for his choral group. And he said, I want to do a requiem with my children's ensemble, and we'll record it here. And so I said, I don't want to do that. I don't want to write a piece about children singing about death. That's Kinder Totenlieder, right?
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
kids don't know anything about that. And so we really need to have another focus. And I thought, you know, I remember very clearly some of my friends who are my age who were from in London. And during World War II, they were moved out of London to Wales mm-hmm. because of all the bombing. After the war was over, they returned and found houses destroyed, some of the parents gone. And I thought to myself, how do kids survive this? I mean, they see it all the time on television, horrible abuse of kids and war and all that. Mm-hmm. Then I recalled when we did it in this performance of Trinity Requiem in Munich, mm-hmm. Mother of one of the performers came up and she said, and she was my age, mm-hmm. and she said, I was in Dresden in January. And that's when they firebombed, the Allied people firebombed mm-hmm. the entire city. And my father, everything was on fire. My father took me out into the garden and threw me into the little pond, the little mm-hmm. fountain, because my hair and my dress were on fire. And she, after that, so I'm thinking, this is what it's all about. How do kids go through this and survive? And how do they come out the other end managing anything? And that's what it's about. Then the kids get it. Yeah. The kids singing it. And that's what made it so important to me. And the perhaps of all the really intense performances, the one that was the strongest was the one maybe 10 years ago, I think it was 8 years ago, in Riga with the famous Riga choir boys. Every March 29th, there is a memorial concert at the big cathedral to memorialize 100,000 people that were taken away by the Soviets because the Soviets wanted to come in and take the property and the agriculture and all that. Mm-hmm. And so here, some of these people who survived come back every year. And I'm there in this filled cathedral with these people, and they're singing my requiem. And my friend Alex from Munich had come in to play organ. He's so wonderful. He knows the work as well as I do. And he said, even up in the distant organ balcony, the intensity of emotion was overwhelming.
This is an incredible piece of music.
Thank you.
I have to say. And I think I better just play it before I start, because when I think about this piece, I just feel like wanting to grab a box of tissues. We listen now to Trinity Requiem by Robert Moran, featuring the Trinity Youth Chorus and members of Trinity Choir, Trinity Wall Street, conducted by Robert Ridgell. This is music by my guest, Robert Moran.